The Brad Sessmatt Show, broadcasting live.
Thanks for being with us. We will have Daniel the Draftnik with us today. Daniel the Draftnik with the NFL Draft coming up next month. We will be out at Harrah's with Daniel the Draftnik and Brian Urlacher, the Hall of Famer with Chicago Bears. That is coming up next month. We'll have John Wilner with us today, Wilner Hotline. John and I need to go into the weeds about Donald Trump. Donald Trump held a college roundtable this last week. What came out of it from John's view? Also, you know, we let the story of Texas canceling out their game with Arizona State in football slide by. And this is going to be a bigger issue than just Arizona State. But I figured we should jump in on this a little bit with John about why Texas said, we're not going to play you now. Because there's some other schools that are not going to play ASU in football because the SEC is going to a 9-conference game. It's a lot. But what's the future hold? Opening comments are brought to you by Desert Financial Credit Union. Desert Financial Credit Union, taking care of you, taking care of your business. As always and through the years, that's Desert Financial Credit Union. We do appreciate their support. It's the start of the tampering period in the NCAAs, in the NFL, I should say. We can tamper in the NCAAs too. Tampering in the NFL with free agency, and it's already out there that Kenneth Walker is leaving the Seattle Seahawks, MVP of the Super Bowl, to go to the Kansas City Chiefs. It has been reported widely that the Cardinals are going to be in on the bidding for Malik Willis, quarterback with Green Bay Packers. All this sounds great. I would like to see some movement. Could you bring Jacoby Brissett back and save money? And would you take a quarterback that high? I would not. I definitely would not. I would consider trading out of 3 because it's not like the Cardinals have all their other positions figured out. So as free agency gets started, and I look at free agency through the lens of, okay, Seattle takes a blow today in losing Kenneth Walker. The Rams get some changes over there. You look at what the 49ers are going through, and then it's your Cardinals. So as free agency unfolds, it's really my lens is on that front. I watched the Suns last night. They took apart Charlotte, which is what they should do. Charlotte's got a nice base of players. But the Suns are starting to figure some things out. And I'm not saying that like they've got it all figured out because Charlotte's not good compared to what they're going to see when it gets to playoff time. Thankfully, mercifully, we're 5 weeks away from the regular season being over. I don't think it's any coincidence. It's kind of funny how the Suns just have had injuries at an inopportune time. Injury after injury after in an inopportune time. It's funny how that works. Could it be that maybe it's not having everybody together on the court because we're saving minutes during the regular season? Could it be? Oh, that's very high conspiracy theory. No, it's watching the NBA through the years. Yeah, about 2 weeks to go, Mark Williams will be back. Grayson Allen will be back. Jalen Green might feel a little, I don't know, 5 weeks to go, Devin Booker might feel a hamstring or a back or something. And then all of a sudden, well, he's ready to go. What a shock. Yeah, if it were late April, there'd be a reason to play these guys. But when you're playing New Orleans and you're playing Charlotte over the weekend, the Bulls got lost the other night was one of the worst, if not the worst game of the season. Okay, you don't lose the Bulls. And they go out on this road trip now that's long. Long road trip. It's like 9 days, and they play Milwaukee twice in the next 11 days, I believe the number is. So that's what's going on that front. Jordan Spurgeon joins us for a couple of moments because I wanted to have Spurge jump in. Spurge, of course, is on his way out to do the Diamondbacks in-game announcing. Or is it the Rockies today? Which one are you doing?
Got the Rockies today, yep.
Rockies today. They're not good, are they?
They're the best spring training team in baseball, but no, they're not good. They put up a fight. They put up a fight against Team USA last week. It was impressive for a little bit.
For a little bit, like an inning. So I wanted to have you on today because you are going to be throwing out a first pitch.
Yep.
You are going to be throwing out a first pitch on Wednesday. So that's a big deal. They just don't let anybody, or maybe they do, throw out a first pitch.
I feel like they're letting anybody.
How did it come to be, Spurge, that you are a first pitch thrower?
Right place, right time. No, my boss Wally, who runs Salt River Fields, he's just a goofball that puts up with a goofball like me. So he was like, "We don't have anybody scheduled on the 11th. If you'd like to come out and throw it," I was like, "Sure, I'm down." So gonna host and do some skits and throw out a first pitch. My co-host Sienna, she did it with her radio show, The Morning Mess, the other day, so I got to do better than they did. One of them was forced to throw left-handed, even though he's a righty, and he did all right. He did all right. He got it to the plate. It might have been 10 feet outside, but he got it to the plate. So that's what we're working with there.
Okay, so what you're saying is they could booby trap you. You could be 100%. Walking a complete disaster. Because I have sent in our group text out that we need butterfly nets and trash can lids behind home plate. We have no idea where the ball is going.
Hopefully not. Hopefully it's just right down the middle. We'll see. I might have to throw a little bit before, but maybe not. Right.
And that is the Diamondbacks A's, right?
Yep, Diamondbacks A's. Should be a fun one.
First pitch, Jordan Spurgeon. There you go.
Yep, crazy.
That is impressive. What have you made out of the Hometown Nine out there? Because I know you're doing the in-game and you're doing skits and having fun and screwing around, but you have watched them. And I know right now the WBC, it feels like, with the WBC going up, it feels like the Cactus League is almost minor league baseball because there's a lot of number 70s and 67s playing right now.
Yeah, I mean, the WBC has all the attention, of course. Like, we're all watching that. I'm going home and watching the WBC. That's what we're all interested in. But, you know, for the D-backs, it's interesting. They just sent Ryan Waldschmidt back down to minor league camp, so we know he won't be on the opening day roster. He then goes 3-for-3.
What do you think
he hasn't played? He hasn't played AAA yet, so I think if Alec Thomas and Jordan Lawler don't work out and Gurriel is too slow to play the outfield coming off an ACL, you might see him midseason later in the year. I think if you wait till at least May, that gives them an extra year of control. That always happens in baseball, so I don't know if they're planning on that. So it just depends. If he goes to AAA and lights it up and the outfield's struggling beyond Corbin Carroll, then, yeah, you'll probably see him this year. If not, if Alec Thomas, who looks great for Team Mexico right now, he had a great game yesterday. Awesome. He looks amazing. So if he continues that with his new swing and if Jordan Lawler figures it out, we're not going to see Waldschmidt this year, and that's okay too. I think they wouldn't be upset about him getting a full year in AAA. I think he only comes up if they absolutely need him this year.
All right. Well, go be brilliant.
Thanks, Brad.
Is today a friends and family game with the Rockies?
Pretty much.
There's nobody there, right? So
a little slower.
Over in section 125, we have so-and-so's mom who's here today.
Hi, pretty mom. Much. One yep, that'll be it. That'll be it today.
This is Spurge's job today. He gets to go out and entertain 300 people. So good stuff.
If we're lucky.
First pitch. Good luck. See you later.
Thanks, Brad. Later.
Spurge jumping in with us for a few minutes. I went hiking with Claudia yesterday. Have you ever seen her segment On the Rocks? She's been doing it. The backstory on the Rocks is, if you guys want to know the inside of our workings, Claudia is my grader when I'm teaching at Cronkite. I've been teaching on the side. I haven't taught in a few years, but I'm teaching at Cronkite. They give me this young lady, Claudia Collins, and it's intern interview day at Cronkite. It's where the interns can walk up to us and they have their bad clip-on ties and they're trying so hard to hit 10-run home runs. And Claudia is not stopping at my table. And I'm sitting with the professor, Paula Bovin, my best friend. And Paula taps me on the shoulder because she's at Cronkite. And she says, "That's the one. That's when it's Claudia just walking across. Claudia from our team." And I said, "Hey, why aren't you over here?" And she said, "Because your internship doesn't pay." Now, this opens up a whole can of worms. I'm of the opinion that if you're going to get grit, because you're not coming here. If you ever want to get in the business and come here for an internship, you're not going to do a typical internship. You're going to learn the John Wooden pyramid of success. You already know how to write. You already know how to shoot. Can you find a story? Are you a good teammate? On and on and on and on. So Claudia's my grader. Claudia, about halfway through the semester, takes a job in the middle of nowhere, Texas. I want to say it was Laredo, or it was just a market like what? Somebody advised her at ASU to go take this job in the middle of nowhere. So she takes it. One day, Jordan Hamm calls me and says, "Hey, Claudia is not doing great down in Texas. The caller, so what's going on? I had to go shoot the high school show tonight. I had to host the high school show tonight. I'm sitting here at a drive-through where they're offering more dollars per hour. I won't even say because it was so low. More dollars per hour than what I'm getting paid here in this little town. I'm ready to quit. I'm like, you're not going to quit. So we talk about a week later. So what do you want to do? What are your hobbies? Well, I like to hike. Okay, well, what if we create a segment and call it On the Rocks? Really? Yeah. What if I got it sponsored and we pay you? Really? Yeah. It's a hike. Just get paid to hike. And she was already in love, and the guy that her husband, and now they have their children. And so yesterday, the four of us were out there hiking. My better half came with me too. And I'm just looking at Claudia like she was this close to punching out of the industry because somebody told her, go to the middle of nowhere and make very little and so on, so on, so on, so on, so on. So I've hiked with her twice. One time we were up at BYU doing a story and she took me up a mountain and I thought I was going to die. And then yesterday was much, much better. But you will see this episode of On the Rocks with Claudia and myself at some point here on the site. All right. With all that said, Daniel the Draftnik. Daniel and I have a conversation about the Max Crosby trade that I think is worth bringing back because it will impact the top of the draft. And then John Wilner, John and I are going to yell at each other today. I can guarantee you that. We are going to yell at each other today. That's coming up a little bit later. I'm Brad Sussmad. And he's back, Daniel the Draftnik. And we talk about the NFL draft coming up on April 18th. Daniel and I, along with Brian Urlacher, will be out at Herzog Chin putting on the draft show. Daniel's expectations are to hit every pick, or almost every pick, as he did last year. We had a couple trades in the last week. And so I'm curious, the shakeup in particular with the Raiders trading Max Crosby off to Baltimore and the Ravens sending back another pick. Okay, let's just look at the Raiders situation now from Daniel the Draftnik's view as to how does this change their draft thought?
Yeah, first of all, you know, hopefully I do get every single pick right. That's kind of the goal every year. I'm really hoping it'd be fun. But yeah, in terms of the Raiders, it's a big gamble by the Ravens. First of all, you're giving up a lot of draft capital to make a move like this, but they need help, obviously, in the pass rush kind of lane. So now you look at the Raiders side and Fernando Mendoza is going to go number one. You're going to address quarterback. And these next 2 days for the Raiders is really going to kind of dictate what they're going to do in the draft. Free agencies here. Tyler Linderbaum is one of the biggest names. And, you know, you address the offensive line in a big need like that. And then at 14, there are three names that I'm kind of circling as potential fits for this team. Jordan Tyson, the receiver out of ASU, for me, fits the Clint Kubiak system that will be run this upcoming season for the Raiders perfectly. A receiver who can play inside out, a guy who's versatile, a guy who can stretch the field, go up and make plays, can take screens, you know, 20, 30 yards down the field if he has to. He's very elusive. That's a guy that I think fits perfectly in this offense. Another guy is Vega Ayon, the offensive guard from Penn State, a big, big guard who for me is such a weird year in the draft because I think some of the best players in this draft are those guys who aren't, you know, positional value really isn't there to take them top 10. You know, Vega's one of them, offensive guard, Styles, linebacker, Jeremiah Love, running back, safeties, Caleb Downs and Dylan Thiedemann are two guys that I really like. But I think this guy is big mauling presence as an offensive guard, has a real, I think, one of the best pass sets I've seen from a guard coming out of college. Just so sturdy, just sits in his chair so well, and just so strong. I think he'd fit really well in the Clint Kubiak system and would help get Genty some open running lanes. And then you look at this defense for the Raiders. There's no real edge rusher I'd take there at 14, realistically, unless someone falls. Someone always falls in the draft. I don't think anyone's going to make it to 14. I think you just get someone versatile, someone who can help you at all three levels. Dylan Thiedemann, safety out of Oregon, is a guy who can play free safety, can play in the box, and has real good range for, you know, a guy who can just make plays silent to silent, and you know, someone the Raiders desperately could use because they need talent desperately on that defensive side.
Okay, and to be clear about this, Max Crosby was a fourth-round pick from Eastern Michigan.
He was.
But one of the best players at his position in the entire NFL. So this is not an exact science. And that leads me over to you have the number one overall pick. And it's pretty straightforward that if they were to keep the pick, that they would take Mendoza at one. But if they decided to go a different direction in free agency, and then they have one, and they have what, 14, right?
14, yeah.
Yeah, they have one and 14. Could they not completely reset? Could they take one and trade back to five and pick up a couple of extra picks? I mean, that roster, and you laid it out well, Daniel, is a disaster. It's a train wreck. And it's more than just let's take a quarterback who's going to get run over. So I'm kind of interested to see if the Raiders think out of the box on this one, as the late great Al Davis would do. And that this trade, sends a message, I think, on Baltimore's end. Jesse Minter comes in, he's seen up close with the Chargers. Max Crosby crushed them. The Raiders were tanking at the end of the season. So he wanted out of there. He's in his prime. I mean, and I think it sends a message to Lamar Jackson's camp that we are serious about winning. So I make it from that side. But I would say, let's take a step back. And maybe it is not going the way of the draft. Maybe it is going free agency for that quarterback.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a fair point. It kind of depends when you look at this free agency cycle. The two guys who really make sense if they were to go to that route is Malik Willis and Kyler Murray. Those are kind of the two guys that would, I think, really fit in this Kubiak system. But I just look at, Mendoza, and I look at what Sam Darnold was able to do last season in this offense. They just kind of go hand in hand. I think Mendoza just has such good ability just to see and just throw it. Now, there was a report coming out that, the Raiders would prefer to start a veteran at the beginning of the season, which I think definitely would help Mendoza. Obviously, I think that's just the smart way to go about it. Just because, he's a guy who didn't really take too many, under center snaps, and that's a whole conversation to go down. But, didn't take too many under center snaps, a lot of RPO, a lot of just in the shotgun, clapping, things like that, not taking a real, snap. So I think getting a veteran, getting a guy in there that can start the first half of the season is another realistic route that they can take. But free agency and trading back, you also got to realize like how much capital would they get trading back? It is a weird draft class where it really is Mendoza, and that's kind of it for the quarterback situation. So how much is a team willing to really go up and get one? Would it be the Jets? Would it be, the Cardinals at three? And what would they realistically give is another question to ask.
See, I trade back and go get Bane out of Miami of Florida and stick him out there, and my defense suddenly gets bolstered. I've got a veteran quarterback that I just had to pay for, and I'm going to go get somebody next year in the draft because I'm not completely sold on Mendoza being the next of the next of the next. I'm going to take that 14th pick, and I would go get Jordan Tyson. I would go get somebody that would help out, or maybe it is on the offensive line. I just think you could go a few different directions now on this deal. Let's move on to the Chiefs. So the Chiefs make a trade. And this one is interesting too for Kansas City, a team that wide receiver wise, they weren't good last year.
No, they were not good last year. And now you look at it, they've just opened up another gaping need in cornerback. So it's going to be a weird situation for the Chiefs, especially at number nine. You just kind of look at just past drafts, and there's always someone who falls. There's always a guy who falls. 2023, Malachi Starks, or 2025 last year, Malachi Starks fell. Jihaad Campbell fell. Christian Gonzalez fell in 2023. There's always a guy who everyone thinks gonna go top 15, gonna go top 10, falls. So at nine, you kind of look at it, like I mentioned, it's a weird draft class. Caleb Downs could be a guy who falls. I think that's a good fit for them. Carnell Tate could fall to nine. Jeremiah Love can fall to nine. I think you just kind of, if you're the Chiefs, you sit there, you wait, you see, okay, who's gonna fall to us at nine? Could be a Reuben Bain, could even be David Bailey. There are so many names that come draft night, we might see them slip a couple picks, and I think the Chiefs just kind of got to sit patient at nine and kind of pick your poison. Whoever kind of falls there is where you kind of sit there and take. I think tackle is a realistic option with that 29th pick that they picked up.
Yeah, but I would say to you, you're wrong. What are you talking about? If Patrick Mahomes' window is closing, it's closing fast. If Travis Kelce decides to come back for another season and they take a safety, no, you've got to do something to help you. You got to do whatever it is because Patrick Mahomes' window is closing. That's that. There's no other way to go, Daniel, the draft Nick.
And I'd counter with, you look at just in terms of value, you look at value in this draft. Receiver is another deep point in this draft class. They pick at 40. right in the beginning of that second round. You look at it, Omar Cooper can fall, Chris Brazel can fall, Skylar Bell can fall. These are so many names that could fall to 40 and they can potentially look at. They don't have the cap space to go get a top guy like Alec Pierce in this free agent class. So that's something. If Carnell Tate falls, like that is a perfect option for them to go get a guy who could go stretch the field and be that intermediate to deep target that Patrick Mahomes loves to have. We've heard reports that Tyreek Hill may be a potential return, but he's coming off of injury. So it's definitely an interesting situation there in Kansas City. But I would say that this is a deep receiver class, and I think at least they will go that direction at 9, 29, or 40.
Daniel the Draft Nick delivering the goods. We will be together out at Harrah's Auction on draft night on April 18th, along with Hall of Famer Brian Urlacher. Good seeing you.
Thanks for having me, Brad.
John Wilner with us for a couple of minutes. It is great to have John Wilner, Wilner Hotline, nationally syndicated columnist, covering the sports of the fun of the world of games of college athletics. Normally, I would lead March Madness the second week in March, but there was a lot that happened in football this last week that I think we need to dive into. So, the news cycle John Wilner chose first, we just let this skate a couple weeks ago where Texas said, we are not playing Arizona State. And they dropped the game. The Sun Devils lose playing Texas. Maybe it's a blessing for them. I don't know. But we're going to start seeing more of this, aren't we, John, of teams dropping big games because it really doesn't help them in the playoff?
Well, there's a little TBD, but the issue specifically, faithful readers of your website might recall in July, I published a column that in which Graham Rossini, ASU's athletic director, said, I'm concerned we may lose a bunch of games against SEC teams if they go to a nine-game conference schedule. That's exactly what happened. So now I believe Texas has canceled the series with ASU. Florida has canceled. LSU is either officially canceled or I think going to officially cancel. And, you know, the Sun Devils kind of expected this. It's a tough spot for everybody because if you're an SEC team – and you all of a sudden have an extra conference game to play, you want to back off a little of your non-conference challenges. So, you know, a lot of schools in the ACC and Big 12 are feeling the impact of the SEC going to nine games. Now, on the broader scale, are we going to lose these matchups in early September that everybody loves? Possibly. There's some rumblings that Alabama will cancel a series against Ohio State. Because of the playoff, you know, everybody's worried if I get another loss.
Right.
You know, if I lose two in conference and then lose one in non-conference, I'm out of the playoff. That's understandable because the committee has screwed up repeatedly by focusing so much on the loss column. You go back through the rankings in December, it's almost based on, you know, descending order of losses. And that sends a bad message. Now, you could argue, sure, Texas would have gotten in the playoff if they hadn't lost to Ohio State. But at the same time, Miami got in the playoff because they beat Notre Dame. So there's an argument to be made both ways. And if you're a school, you know, and you're going to just play three cupcakes, that doesn't do anything for your attendance, for your merchandise, for your ticket, for your enthusiasm on campus. I think those games are important, but the selection committee has got to show that you're not going to get punished for losing one of those games. There's a big strategy here, you know, and it's important that the committee recognizes that there's a bigger picture. There's a bigger story than just, you know, who they're deciding in that room in early December. They need to understand that the good of the game is dependent upon them making the right moves with regard to strength of schedule.
Yeah, but I don't care because I'm Furman. I have to have that game the third week in November because I need the money. My team's going to lose 80-0. We're going to go sacrifice bodies out on the field. And Alabama needs that game because they're going to play their third and fourth stringers and rest up for Auburn the following week.
Right.
You know, John, that – I'm pointing out where I look at the SEC and once upon a time it was, well, this is great for that athletic department. It's so great. No, it's not. Not in this world of CFP. You shouldn't be playing Furman in November. That should not happen ever.
It shouldn't, but you certainly, it's going to be hard for any to convince anybody to play three really good non-conference games, right? The SEC has a policy. So does the ACC and the Big 12. You have to play 10 Power Four opponents, nine conference plus one out of conference. What I think they need to do, all the conferences, is they need to kind of get away from blocking off the first 3 weeks of the schedule for non-conference games. If the SEC teams, just to take your Furman Alabama example, okay, let's say Alabama plays a conference game in week two, then you're basically moving what would be a cream puff in September to a cream puff in November. I'm okay with a cream puff here or there. If you can balance it out with good games in September, conference games in September, why not just play conference games from week one to week 12? You know, why do you have to, you know, silo all the non-conference stuff early? They got to take a more flexible look at their scheduling.
They're not flexible. You know, Arizona State plays NAU every year, and then they play New Mexico. And one year they lost to New Mexico. It was a complete train wreck and a travesty. They've added Stanford, ASU has, in place of the Texas game. Okay, I'm actually okay with that. But I feel like if we're really going to dive down into this playoff, it's an unfair advantage for a team in November to have a cream puff, as you put it, rightly so, where they can rest before they
What if everybody did that? But what if all the conferences had the flexibility
against ASU in November? Are you kidding me?
But what if that meant that ASU's playing Texas Tech in early September?
Oh, they're not ready. These coaches aren't ready.
But right? They need to get ready.
They need to get ready.
Yeah. See, here's one of my pet peeves. Pardon the rant. Any policy regarding college football in which the coaches are part of the decision-making process is guaranteed to be a bad move. They are the worst people, the last people on earth who should be making decisions based on what's best for the game, right? Or you do the old Seinfeld Costanza thing where you do the opposite and you ask the coaches what they want to do, and then you automatically do the opposite. they are the worst ones. They care. And right, they're paid to win games.
Right.
We cannot expect them to be able to make logical, rational decisions based on the good of the game. You got to back burner them, and you got to have the ADs, the commissioners, the TV folks make decisions on changing the entire scheduling model for college football. You can play Furman or NAU in November if that game is replaced in September by a terrific matchup.
Okay. But to your point about coaches. So this last week, Kirby Smart and Josh Heupel, two SEC coaches.
Yes. The
commissioner, by the way, is not in favor of 24-game team playoff. Both came out and said they're in favor of a 24-team playoff. Of course the coaches are going to say, we're in favor of a 24-team playoff because it's going to save me my job and my seven-figure check. Right?
Yes. That's a perfect example. The thing is, and I don't mean to get completely off track, half off track. The same issues happen in college.
Please go completely off track, please.
Well, the same issues happen in college basketball right now, right? They're talking about expanding the NCAA tournament to 76 teams because they want the coaches and ADs want to get more teams in because they get performance bonuses and they get job security. The 2014 playoff and the 76-team March Madness are both bad for the sports, completely unnecessary from a competitive standpoint. We don't need 8-4 Iowa playing in the CFP, and we don't need 16-14 Auburn in the NCAA tournament. But the people who are pushing for this are doing it to save their jobs and earn more money. And everybody needs to recognize that. They are both expansions are bad for the postseasons for their sports.
Okay. Donald Trump was in the news cycle this last week. and it wasn't about the war, which that's a whole different rant on my front. But here he has a White House roundtable to try to fix college athletics. Nick Saban is there. The presidents of the conferences are there. A lot of people were there. Some people were there. I'm like, why is that person there? What was your big takeaway from the roundtable to save college sports?
Well, as SEC Commissioner Greg Sankey has said, big decisions don't get solved in big rooms with lots of people. So to me, the first thing is, one, at the broadest level, Trump actually does care about college football. You know, I think he legitimately enjoys it, and it's a winning political issue for him, right? Where's college football big? Well, it's big in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Georgia, to name a few states. But the thing is, they got a lot of people who have no understanding of the real issues, and including the president, who doesn't understand the real issues. The fact that he suggested they go back to the way it was before pre-NIL shows zero understanding of how we got here in the first place, right? That can't happen. An executive order, which I think he's going to issue either later this week or next week, is going to do nothing, because they got to get either – they would have to have the courts overturn stuff, or they need to have Congress jump in and solve it. An executive order is going to do nothing. It's just good for show. They did not solve a thing. They didn't get closer on any of the key issues. They didn't even have the athletes there, right? They had like 50 people in that room, and not one of them was a current athlete. That tells you a lot, right? It tells you almost everything about the situation. It looks good. It's interesting that the president cares, but they're not closer to solving any of these issues than they were before. They need Congress, and I don't think they're going to get antitrust exemption. They need Congress, or they need to collectively bargain. And until one of those two things happen, the chaos is not going to end.
Okay, before I get you out of here, John Wilner with us for a few minutes. I'm going to leave some meat on the bone this week. But you did write about how the Big Ten and the West Coast basketball schools are really feeling the hurt, and that we're not going to see much when it comes to the brackets being announced in the way of West Coast geographically located basketball programs in the college space. John, how much regret is there behind the scenes with the Big Ten and this move for these schools that have said, let's go do this? Are they already for a couple of years, like, yeah, we get a lot of money, but we're never going to be as good as we could be?
I mean, I think it's two things equally true, especially for Oregon and Washington. They wanted the Pac-12. They wanted to stay. They wanted the Pac-12 to figure out a way to survive with a decent media deal. But I also don't think they're saying this Big Ten move was bad for us, because college basketball is down on the list, right? They made the move because of money, because of football, and because of money. And then college basketball is like fourth. So the fact that Washington and Oregon and USC and even UCLA to an extent are struggling with the travel and with the resources and with the enthusiasm, and their attendances are terrible, it's all secondary to football and the annual checks they're collecting. I'd also add that it's not just the four schools that moved into the Big Ten, right? I mean, ASU is not doing great in the Big 12. Colorado, Utah, Arizona's the only one of the eight that moved into the Big 12 and the Big 10. Arizona's the only one that's thriving in men's basketball, because it's a basketball school. Sure. Big 12 basketball is great. You know, UCLA is a basketball school, but they've got other issues that are preventing them from kind of reaching their ceiling. And they also have bigger travel problems. I mean, Arizona's travel in the Big 12 is much more manageable than UCLA's travel in the Big Ten. I mean, the Bruins are like 3-11 when they cross the Rockies for conference play. They got long trips, and then they come home and they're facing other Big Ten teams that are better rested because they've been playing USC. So they've been sitting in LA for like 5 days.
Got it.
I don't see a way out of this, quicksand for those four schools. I just don't. I think that their basketball programs are doomed to mediocrity in the Big Ten.
John Wilner with us. We'll see you next week. Thanks.
Thanks, Brett.